All right, good morning, Chatty Cathys. It is Tuesday, March 10th, calling this meeting to order. And do we have two, four? We have a quorum? Okay, well then, Representative Reimer, would you like to approve the minutes from last week, which was February or March? March what? March 5th. Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've reviewed the minutes, and my motion is to approve them.
Okay, that sounds awesome. Love that. All right. Any questions about the minutes, comments, concerns? All right, seeing none, minutes approved. First up, we have, let's see here, we have Bolig Engineering up to talk about the current cost drivers for drinking water and sewer infrastructure projects. As you know, our committee is seeing is it billions of dollars worth of water projects in this committee? And one of the questions that we frequently ask each other on this committee is, why are the costs so high? It's like, why is the rent so darn high? Why is the water so darn high? So with that, we will turn it over to Bolig Engineering. And if you would state your name for the record and proceed. And then, oh, by the way, you have about 20 minutes. So let's say, let's go about 40. Yeah, 10:40. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Bolig. I am president and founder of Bolig Engineering. To my right is Laura Ossel, our funding program manager. And to my left is Bill Dunn, our senior funding advisor. So today I want to talk about some of the costs that are driving both drinking water and wastewater projects. Minnesota obviously is very unique, but there's 856 communities in the state, 83% of which are under 5,000 in population, and 71% of those are under 1,000. Bolig Engineering was created to help those small communities under 5,000 understand what their infrastructure is about, how to prioritize that, and how to help them navigate the complexities of funding. We're about 50 people. We have offices across the state. Our largest practice is municipal engineering. We do about 90% of our work. Our other about 5% is aviation consulting for airports across the state. We also do some architectural work, the construction administration for all those projects, and the funding assistance as well. We're uniquely qualified. Many of our staff live or grew up in small communities and are uniquely qualified and understand how communities react and how to talk about their communities and their infrastructure in ways that they can understand and appreciate. So our councils are making their informed decisions for themselves. We see a huge difference in resources and staff. Generally, larger communities have multi-layers of staff. Often they have staff that are project managing the consultant. The smaller communities don't have those kind of budgets to employ large staff. So often they might have 2 to 5 staff people per community. Typically without engineering or strategic planning backgrounds. Really, the municipal engineering and our focus as our code of ethics is really to protect the public health and safety, capital investments within a community, financial security to ensure those projects are affordable and people don't get too far out on a limb on different costs. And really, it's the public trust system. And the funding agencies all require public hearings and discussion of improvements. And so it's very important that we're able to communicate that effectively across all levels. Our slogan has been neighbors serving neighbors. It's really our rural Minnesota slogan that, again, we infiltrate a community to the extent that they need our help. Some of our communities don't know how to even sign up for a SAM number. And as you know, SAM.gov is required to access any federal programs. And so we help our communities where they need help, and we back off where communities have these access on their staff already. We like to refer to ourselves as we're designed for small cities. This is where we function, this is where we live, and this is where we're uniquely qualified. This is just a quick slide on where some of the funding is coming from the small communities. We've been able to help our communities with almost $300 million of funding. $176 million of that has been on the federal side. This is both loans and grants that come to our communities. About $96 million through the state, and sometimes there's different cash that communities themselves have to put in addition to the other sources. I think the other thing that's really unique, in order to create affordable projects in our communities, they need multi-layers of funding to access. We're often trying to bring three to seven different funding sources into one particular community to help them create an affordable project. One of the drivers of some of the cost has been we've been accessing a lot of federal monies, which has been really good for our communities, but it's very intensive. These are some reports that we have to prepare for our communities. This has taken 1,000 hours of time to put this report together. This is a full-time person, a half a year, to put these reports together. And often these reports, they're required to access the federal monies, but they often need to look at the entire infrastructure of the community, even improvements, even infrastructure that's not being improved. And so they're an extremely labor-intensive project managing tool, but it's the way that our communities can access some funding, and they need our help to do that. Through the legislators have asked different to itemize some of these costs and these needs that's more easily identifiable. And so we've used a one-page briefing sheet to help legislators understand the needs of the community, the costs, what the PPL scores are. What's working, what's not? Again, most of our money has been coming from the federal government. The nice thing is there are low-interest loans. There's federal grants. Because they go out 40 years, they bring more loan on top of our communities. Some of the cons I already mentioned of 1,000 hours, but these reports can get upwards of $75,000 to perform. And it's becoming exhaustive to continually pay more and more on the front end for some of these reports. On the PFA side, they also have lower interest loans and often lower than the federal rates. It's much easier to access the funding. They don't have some of the bureaucracy that's there on the federal side. They have a low affordability rate, so when PFA looks at what they can fund a particular community for drinking water, they look at 1.2% of their median household income is what they should afford to be able to pay on their own. If numbers exceed that, they help bring that down if grants are available. Often we've found our highest degree of success when RD and PFA pairs together. This is where we can really help and leverage bringing in that federal loans and grants. Often in our communities, this infrastructure, nobody sees it. Nobody understands it. And there isn't a lot of planning or on-site work in here. We've had a Tracy, Minnesota, just lost part of their street, got sunk in because their stormwater is collapsing underneath this past winter. Their drinking water mains, some in their town are nearing 100 years old, well past their useful life. They're corroding so badly that the city has built a trailer to ground and just fix water main breaks. But one particular break they were mentioning is when they found the break and replaced it, they pressed a drill on the upstream side and they hit solid metal, and they pressed a drill on the downstream side and it just broke right through the metal with just hand pressure. A lot of their pipes are staying together with just the soil and the ground. And so there's going to be some continually issues in that community for a long time. Now I want to switch the presentation here a little bit and talk about these cost drivers. Obviously, inflation during COVID, we had a huge spike, supply chain issues, all sorts of things. This helps us understand those inflation. We've seen the inflation come down dramatically. But we need to look at a different graph, the Consumer Price Index, to see how the prices have changed over time. And so past 10 years, we're seeing a 33% increase in pricing. You might ask yourself, well, we're seeing prices that are coming in a lot higher than that. And you're right, there are. Let's talk through that a little bit. First of all, what drives market pricing? So anything over $175,000 needs to be competitively bid in the public market. This is principally the best driver of competition on these projects and creating affordable projects. The market decides the price. It's really not the engineer that decides it, nor the contractor. It's what people are willing to pay for this work. A lot of factors go into that, but one thing is consistent across the entire state is that we live in a climate that's colder than other states. We have to bury our pipes deeper to keep them from freezing. And so that inherently has a cost increase to it. Other costs we see is material and labor supplies going up. Market uncertainty has been a big one. We're seeing some contractors that are moving, since there wasn't a lot of funding last year, they moved to North Dakota and South Dakota for work. And we just don't want to lose those permanently. They provide a good competitive for our small communities. Here, just a little bit of understanding of 8-inch water main. Essentially, everybody in this state, one time or another, will use an 8-inch water main. The orange here is the cost of insulation change of that pipe over time. The blue is the pipe cost itself. So what we've seen in the latter half of 2021 and beyond really 23 and beyond is that costs are starting to decrease and help drive costs down, but construction costs seem to continue to increase. And we're seeing different pieces of that. We're hopeful that those will start to drop, but there are other drivers that are increasing that construction cost. And we'll get into some of the labor prices a little bit later that'll help tell that story more. Another one I wanted to look at is just concrete and trying to understand why concrete prices have gone up so much pre-COVID versus post-COVID, when 80% of concrete is rock, sand, and water. So what is driving that cost higher? Well, we're seeing cement cost increasing in cost. We're also seeing that because we're shutting down the coal plants in North Dakota and elsewhere, we can't use the byproduct that's generated, which is fly ash, and it goes into cement, and then we're able to decrease the amount of cement. So pre-COVID, we used a lot of fly ash. Post-COVID, we're not using as much, so now we use more cement. So that's been a definitely a plus. We're all see even the cost of a pumper truck is almost, it's a $500,000 today. So there's cost in here of equipment that's changing. And the cost of a driver, concrete driver in outstate Minnesota pre-COVID was about $60,000 a year, working 60-hour weeks. That cost is now $90,000 to $100,000. And so the costs are changing. If we look at this particular graph, this helps illustrate the cost pre-COVID and post-COVID when we look at the balance between what the cement price is doing versus what the actual concrete cost after we add the rocks and the sand and the water and the cement to it and how that's changing. Pre-2020, that price of cement varies when you see the price of concrete kind of varies with it. Post-COVID, we're seeing an imbalance occur that the price of concrete seems to be still going up, even though the cost of cement is now starting to come down. The part that's encouraging is in 2025, we saw our lowest increase in cement cost. It's still going up, but at a lower rate than it used to. We're hoping that that'll continue, that trend. I want to jump into water treatment plants. They're very complex and have a lot of different components and want to help you understand that a little bit more. Pre-COVID, 43% of the cost was attributed to buildings, process equipment, and electrical controls. Post-COVID, we're seeing that same cost of those three items go from 43 to 72% of the total cost. And when we start to dial down a little bit deeper and start to look at those three individually, building costs have gone up 55%. So they're exceeding the CPI index. The process, the equipment used to treat, has gone up nominally, but we're just going to be starting to experience our BABA and how that's going to affect funding and how to build things in America. And we're going to see some dramatic changes to that process equipment going forward. The biggest driver, however, has been electrical and controls. It has seen a 300% increase in cost over time. And honestly, we don't see that trend decreasing. Most of our electrical controls have been caught from overseas and come to America, and now we're going to have to be building them in America at our higher labor rates. So we're going to see that continually to outpace the CPI index. This is just a quick illustration of just labor cost in general over time. And as you can see, the CPI index on the bottom in orange, followed by the labor cost on the top. Around the COVID years, we saw a little slight spike up. After COVID, it decreased, but the rate overall is still increasing faster than the CPI index is. Then what's really working and what's not? We think the legislative visits, when legislators come out of Boston, come out to the individual communities, our communities get to see you all as real people. And you get to see their community and where they live. It's really been fruitful to see that. They can understand more what you go through because they recognize who you are and see you as a person. I think that's been very helpful. The PFA program traditionally has been really the primary funding source in Minnesota, and that's working. And really, I want to see just leveraging the state and federal funding together. That's really been key to the rural communities. Some of the things maybe that could be improved upon, when some years we have funding and other years we don't, and we see those contractors move across state lines, that's hurting our ability and competition back home. If we can get some some of those fluctuations brought back down, that would be helpful. The costs in Greater Minnesota are just higher than we see in other areas. And I think the other part is that there's a lower tax base in our cities, in the smaller communities, that's harder to pay for other things with. User rates are the primary driver for water and sewer rates, but it's paying for the other things that go with the complexity of projects. And without that tax base being strong, it takes a lot on the communities. So I'd like to just end here and just open it up for any questions and answers I could address from members.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple questions on cost drivers. So, and we've seen this with other entities as well. If you have no competition for the services, you know, if you're the sole engineer, if you're the sole entity providing, where's the competition to have the market decide for these small communities in terms of either their engineering or their overall development?
Mr. Bullock.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. So one of the things that BOLIC does, and I think we tried to do this purposely, is that communities can go out for a request for proposal and look for an engineer, and the engineers will spend $5,000 to $10,000 putting that together, coming and doing a presentation, dressing up in suits, and giving that presentation to the community. The community really still doesn't understand who those people are and what they can do for them. All they hear is promises. We wanted to take that a step back, and rather than spend that money internally, we want to show a community how we work, how we do. And so often we'll come into a community and provide a high-level needs assessment and look at their needs. They can understand how we do that and how we listen to them and how we put that together. If it's a match and the community likes us, then we move forward with further planning. If it's not a match, then we leave. But we feel better that showing them what we can do is far superior than just putting things to paper.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then switching to the actual product. So when you're doing cement, you may have rebar as well. So you've got steel costs, you've got the cement cost, hauling, trucking. If there are fewer, I know in one of the areas near one of my farms, there's only one cement business left. So then the market, there's not competition. So if you want cement, you gotta pay for it. So concrete. If you want concrete, I was actually, my master's was on fly ash, so I was hoping that he was going to say poslinetic ability, but didn't happen. So where are we with, you know, again, tariffs, war, in terms of costs on some of these components of concrete, but also with the monopolies? Like, if there's only one entity, how does that drive cost for the cost that we're being asked to pay for from the state?
And who would like to take that?
Mr. Bullock? Thank you, Madam Chairperson. You're right. The monopolies are changing. When I was growing up, the government would break things up, and so there'd be more competition, and that doesn't seem to happen right now, and I don't know why. More on the federal level. I think in Minneapolis area, there's like three main gravel pit suppliers. That's not a lot. And so a lot of it has to do with permitting and how hard it is to open up new gravel pits. But you're exactly right. The competition is difficult when you only have a couple suppliers in an area. It's still, we look at when we put things out for bids. Like, we have a project bidding, it's a rural development project bidding in Wood Lake right now, and we've got 17 prime bidders on it. So that's really healthy. We're getting a lot of competition. That helps. But when you only have one or two bituminous suppliers in the area, that's challenging. And that's why some of the costs are higher in markets that don't have access to multiple contractors or vendors that provide similar service.
All right. With that, we are out of time, and we have two questions. We have three, but we don't have it. We really have to go because we do not want to be in a predicament like Chair Fredericks was last week. So we're going to go really quick. I'm going to have you, all three of you, just ask your question, and then we'll just have the testifiers answered at one time, okay? First up was Representative Scraba. Ask your question.
I'll support Luke on this. You did a great job. Trust me. Trust me.
Ask your question.
One of the questions that I have is you have pointed at labor, and then pumper truck equipment. Why, if we decide not to do bonding for 3 years, because one of your comments was, if there's no work, everyone leaves, and then the price technically should come down then because it'll be more competitive when we do the work. I'm struggling. I think it's atrocious that anyone should have to pay $164 a yard. I don't see the value in that. I'm sorry. I mean, I grew up when it was 12 and 14, and now it's gone crazy. A new pumper truck, Schwing puts its price on, all that. How do we, as the people that fund it, how do we bring some of these costs down?
Okay. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So two quick questions. One tying to that, just more of, so does that make a case for why we should have a bonding bill every year so that we can have that certainty for the labor markets? And then I think the second piece is just more generally, when you talk about your communicating with these communities, to what extent do you encourage regionalization, or is that something that you wait for them to bring that up before you explore that opportunity?
And then quickly, Representative Sexton, and then we'll let you guys have the floor and finish up.
So one thing you didn't talk about was ever-tightening specifications, which actually adds costs. No good deed goes unpunished. We try and do good deeds here, but then you're going to see it in the cost.
All right. All right. Mr. Boleg, you got all that?
All right. I got most of it. Mr. Chair, President, I'll go ahead and answer. I'm going to start from the reverse backwards. So the specifications for like water main, they've been consistent for a large number of years. We need to get a 6-foot burial. We see water main out there at 8-foot burial in Minnesota. Yes. We see it out there for 6-foot. It's breaking. Let's get it down to 8-foot. There's standardization in that. When we come back to treatment plants and we have to treat to a higher level, we have to remove PFAS or we have to remove manganese, an emerging contaminant, we have to put more equipment in. And so that's going to cost more and drive up costs. The other thing that's been driving that cost is there's been, I think on a federal level, that a hyper cybersecurity that everything has to be accessible by the web. And so it's driving the additional controls that we're putting in the plant. And I think that's one area that we could possibly come backwards on. And now we're hearing from the Iran war that cyber attacks are coming. And if we weren't connected to the web in the first place, we wouldn't be attacking some of our water plants. And so I think that's something that we could take a look at. Representative Lee, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. It's regionalization. All right, thank you. This is awesome. And this is what the rural waters have been doing across really southwest Minnesota and up in northwest Minnesota, getting access, lower-cost water to our communities. Red Rock Rural Water, Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water, these are helping tremendously, and it's something that we need to continue to do. If there's ways the legislators could build in some sort of piece in here that encourages regionalization, that maybe gives an extra bonus or funding towards regionalization, I think that would help pull communities. There's this there's this, every community wants to have their independence, and at the same time, if you give them a reason to help them want to regionalize, I think they'll want to go that way. That'll make sense. And then, Representative Strobel, would you mind just repeating just real quickly?
Representative Scraba, and it had to do about the cost.
I just, the labor costs and the equipment costs, and if it keeps going up, if we decide not to do it, how does that affect the final price in the years to come?
The hard part is that the contractors that are here need to feed their family, and so they're going to go somewhere else, and you're going to lose them. And I don't think they'll come back if the funding just stops. And then prices will, we haven't seen prices go up yet. They'll really go up. One of the encouraging signs, we did a project in the city of Amboy late this year. We just had to get it in the ground. And so we got some contractors that were actually coming back from the Dakotas and bid on. They actually had to have work. And so they were working out there, but we got some significantly good pricing on that. We've got to try and get the competition as high as we can. We need those contractors. We need those community, those contractors that work in small communities to stay in Minnesota. We're going to keep that going as best we can.
All right. With that, thank you so much for coming down to St. Paul and testifying today. We appreciate you. And safe travels back home.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representatives, very much.
All right. We've got the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Please make your way to the testifying table. You do have 10 minutes. And you can state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is John Kelly. I serve as the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Governor's 2026 capital budget recommendations for the department. This slide shows the mission of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We proudly serve Minnesota's veterans, their dependents, and survivors by connecting them with federal and state care and the benefits that they have earned. To accomplish this mission, we run the state's veterans homes and assist the state's nearly 300,000 veterans and their dependents in securing available benefits and services. This slide shows our location statewide. Thanks to the leadership and partnership of the legislature, Minnesota now has 8 veterans homes and 4 state veterans cemeteries across the state. The offices of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs are primarily in the Veterans Services Building in St. Paul, the Henry Whipple Federal Building in Bloomington, the Fargo, North Dakota Claims Office has a large portion of western Minnesota is served by the Fargo VA healthcare system. The next slide shows an update on how the department has allocated the asset preservation funding it received in the 2025 bonding bill. With the $7.5 million appropriated to the department, we have targeted the projects across our state veterans homes and cemeteries, totaling just under $7.8 million. So as you can see on the slide there, it shows both cemetery and homes process across our footprint. The slide here, so we have our first priority is asset preservation. You're going to hear that. I'm sure you've heard this from all the state agencies, but we are also in need here. We are grateful for the $7.5 million we received. We have 71 buildings across the state with a replacement value of nearly $500 million. 12 of these buildings are part of our state veterans homes and have a 24/7 occupancy. We have renovations and upgrades to be made with asset preservation dollars to ensure our 900-plus residents are in facilities in good condition. Many of our state veterans' homes have recently been ranked by U.S. News & World Report as some of the best nursing homes in the United States, and asset preservation dollars will go towards a long way towards helping maintain the quality of care for our residents. So in the governor's capital budget recommendation, we have the department is asking for $23.7 million in asset preservation dollars. This will go towards deferred maintenance in our homes and cemeteries. So this slide shows examples of projects in our asset preservation request. These projects include roof, boilers, mechanical and electrical replacements, and other critical repairs. Specific examples from our asset preservation list include $158,000 at our Minneapolis home for plaster work, to $1.7 million our Silver Bay home for plumbing systems and fixtures for single-use restrooms, which is a priority from a health and safety standpoint as well as a strong preference from our residents. As you can see from this slide, this request is intended to address the backlog of our highest priority asset preservation needs. Much of this funding would target historic structures still in daily use at our Minneapolis campus. Some of these buildings are more than 100 years old. So this next slide here shows the second 2025 governor's capital budget recommendation for MDVA, which is something we've been calling the pivot. Due to the unlikeliness that Minnesota will be able to secure the matching funds from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, MDVA is proposing a pivot away from the tear down and rebuild project that is needed state home construction grant matching funds. And instead utilizing the remaining $62.3 million of the existing $77 million rider toward significant improvements at the Hastings and Minneapolis domiciliary facilities. In Minneapolis, Building 16 is a domiciliary program resident building that is occupied 24/7. Both pre-design and design work was paused. This new funding would allow the agency to move to the next stages of design and complete the remodel of the space for our residents. This next slide shows the key considerations that went into the decision to do the pivot. If we do nothing, the funding authorization will end in 2027 without having made any improvements to any state veterans home buildings at Hastings or improving the quality of life for its residents. This pivot does not require any new funding in the 2026 capital investment bill, only a language change to the 2023 rider language. In addition to the critical improvements for buildings on the Hastings campus, this change would allow would fund the renovation of Minneapolis Building 16. While not what was originally planned, if the Hastings pivot and Minneapolis Building 16 renovation were to pass in the 2026 session, the state of Minnesota will have made historic investments in all three levels of care for Minnesota's veterans. This slide shows the specific projects that we're proposing to do with the remaining dollars at Hastings. And then this next slide shows the remaining Minneapolis project that was a high priority. It was the number two priority for the department in last year's bonding bill. It remains a priority for the department. The Building 16 has had periodic failures, serious HVAC condition that needs improving. And so, we are feeling confident that with the utilizing the 2023 dollars to do both Hastings and Minneapolis Building 16, we would be setting ourselves up to have added three new veterans homes, a fourth cemetery, and critical improvements to both domiciliary facilities. Thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee today, and with that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Sexton.
Madam Chair, as I look at the governor's budget for bonding dated January 15th, it showed the cancellation of the 62.372 that I think you had allocated for Hastings. Is that a change based on your slide?
Madam Chair, Representative Sexton, we are not canceling those funds. We are repurposing those funds. So if the governor's budget states that we would be reallocating those funds towards renovation rather than canceling them back.
Okay.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming today. Do you anticipate any impacts with the federal pausing and cuts or anything?
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, so the biggest problem that we're facing has nothing to do with who's in charge of the federal government currently. The problem is that the State Home Constructions Grants Program overall for the entire country has an over $1 billion backlog. They cleared the list completely in 2021. They it was over $600 million, and it has ballooned up to over $1 billion. We had just received, over successive years, matching funds for our state veterans' homes. We felt confident that with the clearing of the law of the backlog that they would continue to do that, and we went for and were able to push for the funds with the state-owned construction grants program for Hastings. One of the reasons why we didn't do a renovation proposal for Hastings was because of the, as I mentioned in my testimony about the single-use bathrooms, that is a high priority. That is, our three new veterans homes have all single-use bathrooms. This is a health and safety, and as more gender diverse population of veterans ages into our homes, it's also a priority from a standpoint of the department. That being said, domiciliary facilities are ranked lower in the state construction grants program rankings than skilled nursing. And so we were ranked 88th of 89 projects on the fiscal year 25 list. We've tried now for the several years. We are still on the list. We've done all of the requisite pre-design and design work, but it's just not likely, unless they came in and clear that backlog, that we're going to get the funding. And we want to make sure that we're utilizing these funds from the legislature to make significant improvements. This will have a large impact on the quality of life of our residents in Minneapolis and in Hastings. And while it's not what we envisioned, we are still going to be able to do some significant upgrades to improve quality of life for our residents. But again, it's due to the backlog from the state construction grants program, and it has nothing to do with the federal VA. The federal VA is forward funded. So even in this most recent government shutdown, our programs that rely on federal funding were not impacted. And if there was a subsequent shutdown, they would also not be impacted. So they forward fund a year.
Chair Lee. Oh, Representative Lilly.
Just really quick, I just want to thank you. It was some of my favorite stops was in the past going to Silver Bay, and then this time going to Fergus. You've just been really great stewards of the money, and just what a great place that you're, you know, providing to our veterans.
Thank you.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director. I'm a little bit confused. So can you walk us through that again? So you say we rank 88 out of 89. Is that for the federal government or whatnot? And then I think the part where I'm confused is talking about our backlog at the state that's making it that we're not getting the federal funding or whatnot?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Chair. So there is a program from the federal VA called the State Homes Construction Grant Program. That program from the federal VA currently is underfunded. So there are over a billion dollars on that list of projects, including ours. We are seeking $135 million in matching funds. There's over $1 billion in project asks. Last go around, they funded 4 projects. The current list that's on the Secretary's desk for fiscal year 26 is $275 million. So there's a delta between that $275 million and the $1 billion that's on the list. And we, as a proposal for a skilled domiciliary program, are ranked lower than skilled nursing projects from other states. There's not a backlog here. We simply have been trying to secure the funding. The state did its part in 2023. We came up with the matching funds, made us eligible to apply. But we have not been successful in securing those funds, due to the fact that the list comparative to the asks total for the entire country is woefully inadequate. So in 2021, they had $600 some million worth of asks, and they completely funded it, and they have not done that since. And so while they've increased it from, I think it was $189 million in the fiscal year 25 list to $275 million in the fiscal year 26 list, it's still not enough to get to us. So what we're asking for takes up a significant portion of the entire amount of funding that's been allocated by Congress.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just quickly, you went through this already. So you're saying that right now skilled nursing is scoring highly more than what we're proposing for our proposal right now then?
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Chair Lee, yes. So the federal VA's scoring system ranks skilled nursing projects higher and higher priority than a domiciliary facility, which Hastings is a domiciliary facility. And so because of that, you know, when we applied for our skilled nursing facilities in Preston, Montevideo, and Bemidji, they ranked higher than a domiciliary project from another state would.
Shirley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick comment. And so I think, you know, this is really important for us to think through this as last week when we heard from the Department of Military Affairs with what Representative Sexton said, where we don't really know, you know, if we put in the money for the pre-design in Duluth, we're going to get the federal funds. And, you know, right now we put in over $70 million and we're not getting what we thought we were going to get. And so really appreciate the feedback that Representative Sexton brought forth last week. And I think that's something that we should consider highly when we think about this or Department of Military Affairs or other projects that may be dependent on federal funds. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And Representative Sexton's comments did ruffle some feathers. So anyway, thank you for your testimony today. We appreciate you. Members, if you have further questions, you can take them offline. Next, we are going to go to the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Make your way to the front and please state your name for the record. And then you may proceed with your testimony and I will give you 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes. Yeah, go to 15 and then we'll take 5 minutes for questions.
Sounds okay. Good. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and good morning. My name is Nancy Dobenberger, and I am privileged to serve as Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thank you for allowing us a little time on the agenda today for presenting our governor's recommendations for MnDOT capital budget items. And I'm joined by my colleague, Josh Knatterud-Hubinger, who is our CFO, and he is here to help with any questions and running the slide deck. So next slide. Thanks. So I'll start out with noting that MnDOT is a multimodal transportation agency, and our vision is for a multimodal transportation system that maximizes the health of people, the environment, and our economy. And our mission is to connect and serve all people through a safe, equitable, and sustainable transportation system. Next slide. And just an overview of our system, again, multimodal system, and this is by the numbers, but just real briefly, Minnesota has the fourth largest roadway system in the United States. So that's including interstates and state highways, which are under MnDOT's responsibility, as well as local roads and tribal roads. And we have 7 active ports, 34 transit providers serving all 80 non-metro counties. So Greater Minnesota Transit is what MnDOT oversees, and 132 publicly owned state-funded airports and over 4,000 rail line miles. Next slide. So just to touch on recent past funding, in 2025, there were $47 million of general obligation bonds for local road improvement program projects, and $31 million in GO bonds for local bridge replacement program projects, $1 million in GO bonds for highway rail grade crossings, and $1 million GO bonds for Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, or MRSI program dollars. And just a note for MnDOT Roads and Bridges, recall that back in 2023 session, there was $200 million in funding of trunk highway bonds for the Blatnik Bridge project, and that was the local match to our federal infra grant funding. Next slide. All right. So for the governor's 2026 budget recommendations, infrastructure plan for MnDOT items, recall overall there's a $907 million total capital investment recommendation, and of that, $68 million is for transportation programs and projects. There are way more needs than money, so local agencies asked for $3 billion, state agencies asked for $3.8 billion, totaling $6.8 billion. The governor's recommendation in total, again, $907 million, so not possible to include funding for all programs requested, but $68 million is the recommendation for transportation, and that's a combination of trunk highway bonds, GO bonds, trunk highway fund cash, and general fund cash. And we are looking forward to working with legislators on a bill that addresses needs across the state. And so I will go into a little more detail on this. Next slide. So there are four items for MnDOT in the governor's recommendations, and that, again, totaling $68 million. That includes pavements, ports, drainage or hydraulic assets, and the transportation building. And I'll describe these in a little more detail in just the next few slides. So the first one we are calling the High Priority Pavement Program. And you will note the largest or majority of the $68 million recommendation is for $50 million of that in Trunk Highway GO bonds for pavement projects across the state highway system, again, state roads. Pavement conditions are projected to decline significantly over the next 10 years, and that is shown in our Capital Highway Investment Program, or CHIP. It's a 10-year program, and the pie chart on this slide depicts the investments planned for the next 10 years. And the largest slice of that pie, the green slice, shows the pavement investment plan. And although pavements are in fairly good condition now, I'll show the projection of the conditions on the next slide. So this bar chart shows pavement conditions back to 2019 over on the left and through 2024, and then the two far right sets of bars show predicted conditions for 2029 and 2035, so out almost 10 years. The dark blue is the interstate pavement. The percent poor target is to be under 2% for interstates. The green is the national highway system, and the target there for percent poor is to be under 4%. And the lighter blue is the non-NHS or non-highway national highway system pavements, and the target there is to be under 8%. So you can see we've done well managing and investing in our pavements over recent years, but now is the time to invest in pavements to prevent them from deteriorating exponentially over the next 10 years. So our eight MnDOT districts across the state have identified projects they could either move up into the program or increase the scope to achieve a longer-term fix or a longer service life with those projects. And maintaining pavements in a state of good repair is important. They are highly visible, have a direct impact on safety and commerce and tourism and, of course, just daily travel. Right, next. So the second recommendation is for our Port Development Assistance Program. This is for $4 million in GO bonds to support infrastructure needs of public ports, and that would include upgrading facilities and infrastructure as well as rehabbing and expanding port capacity. Next slide. And the importance of investing in our ports really is to promote economic development in and around the ports and harbors. So there are 35 million tons of cargo that move through just the Duluth port each year and $1.3 billion in annual business revenue. And then another 60% of Minnesota's agricultural exports, wanted to note, are shipped on the Mississippi River. And from a recent meeting we had with our Ports Association, they noted there is a need for $54 million in ports for 2026, up to 80% state funds and a minimum of 20% local share is what's needed as they pursue federal funds. Just to reflect on recent past investments, in the 2023 session, the Minnesota Legislature appropriated $18 million to the Port Development Assistance Program. And just to note, seven projects from five applicants were selected to receive funding through the program. Next slide. The third is our Drainage Asset Management Program, or as we call it with the acronym DAMP. I just want to note there on the state highway system, well, we're recommending $4 million, and this would enhance safety, reduce vulnerability to extreme precipitation events, and minimize expensive emergency maintenance. And again, this is just on the state highway system. And MnDOT is the largest owner of hydraulic infrastructure in the state. Our agency owns and maintains culverts, storm systems, ponds,
structural pollution control devices, and this investment will help us to track, assess, prioritize, and repair vulnerable hydraulic infrastructure. Capital improvements may include highway culvert and storm sewer system rehabs, flood resiliency improvement projects such as armoring areas that overtop quite frequently, long-term monitoring of vulnerable hydraulic infrastructure, and just want to note that most of our existing infrastructure was designed based on historical rainfall and flood data, but the capacity of the hydraulic system is not enough to mitigate the increased frequency of extreme precipitation events. So improved drainage asset management is really something we've been working on over recent years, but this investment will help us to develop that risk management system more quickly and address more capital hydraulic needs. And just a little bit more on the condition. We do have 2,660 bridges over water on the state highway system, and that does include culverts that meet the definition of a bridge. So there are box culverts that are 10 feet wide, or that's the span, or greater, that meet the definition of a bridge. And they are included in that number. But there are also another 70,000 culverts, 80,000 storm sewers, and 1,700 stormwater facilities. And there have not been previous appropriations for specific drainage infrastructure. Next slide. And the last of the four, our transportation building remodel. So this is a recommendation of $8 million in trunk highway funds and $2 million in general funds to remodel the transportation building. And this would enable MnDOT to renovate existing workspaces in the transportation building. And MnDOT aims to vacate approximately two, ideally two and a half floors, which will gain us about $1 million per year in lease savings. And also these funds will be used to improve energy efficiency, security measures, and accessibility. Just want to note too, the building was constructed in the 1950s, last remodeled in the 1990s, and that was with trunk highway bonds and cash. And the Department of Administration is seeking a little over $12 million in general funds to design, construct, remodel, and equip the space in the building that would be vacated by MnDOT for other agencies to be able to, state agencies from the Centennial Building to be able to move into the transportation building. So this would reduce our footprint on the Capitol complex. And just a little bit more on this building renovation recommendation. So general funds are required to align with the law and legislative intent of regarding the use of trunk highway dollars. So that's why there's the split here on ongoing operations, maintenance costs are split 75-25, trunk highway cash, general fund cash. And just reflecting on recent past investments, just last year, just over $97 million was appropriated using trunk highway cash for a new state patrol headquarters, but that went to DPS, not MnDOT. Great. So thank you for your time today. And again, MnDOT looks forward to working with our legislators on a bill that addresses needs across the state. And I stand for questions.
Thank you. I have a question. This is regarding to a project that's going on in my district that the residents are really quite upset about. Okay. And it's on the Highway 71 in Sauk Center. So some roundabouts and all the things that go along with it. And the residents feel that during the public testimony, when there was town meetings about it, that their concerns were not heard. And the response from MnDOT has been, too bad, this is a state project, it's going forward anyway, and there's a lot of concerns about safety. It's an old community. There's a lot of foot traffic going across, and that roundabout is going to impede. And so I would like to talk with the department about that and how we can navigate the situation and make both sides happy.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. And yeah, I don't have all the specifics here to address that right now, but I would be happy to sit down with you and talk through that with you and others from the district who are closer to the
project. Yeah, so if I know we're going to be sending a letter with a bunch of questions that the residents have, and then personally, I would like to have a town hall meeting with MnDOT and the residents together so we can listen to both sides, so I can listen to both sides. Chair Kosnick, did you have? Okay. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Kosnick. I know you're very close to this department with chairing transportation. I have a question in regards to the district I represent here, the Capitol Complex. You're asking for $2 million of general funds for the remodel of the transportation building. What's the severity of that? Because, you know, we've got a lot of things in my district that need funding for development. So I'm wondering, what is the severity of this remodeling?
All right, who would like to take that one?
All right. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative, for that question. The importance of remodeling the building is so that we can modernize space and consolidate our staff team members on using more effectively floors that we have and being able to free up floors for others to be able to move in from other parts of the Capitol complex, like the Centennial Building.
Representative Perez Vega.
So just curious, it's not a severe necessity, especially when we don't have such a large budget this year. I really want to place the importance of it. You know, is the roof collapsing? Is there damage to it? I mean, we heard from our veterans, Department of Veterans, who have been showing us what's happening in their buildings. And I just want to be very precise as to a request of $2 million for another Capitol Complex building.
All right. Ms. Neubauer? I can't pronounce it. Dobenberger?
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, thank you for that. I would not describe any dire needs we have in the building, but funds are needed to be able to work on that consolidation. So once we get funds for working on consolidation, modernization, we can move to be more efficient with space in the building.
And Ms. Dobenberger, how many individuals are actually coming into the office? Are we going to be doing new work for people that aren't going to show up that are working from home?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we have a policy, an enterprise policy of those who can telework for their job still need to come into the office at least 50% of the time. But when you look at all of MnDOT, there are only about one-third or a little more than one-third of our employees who can telework for their jobs. Those in the transportation building, most of them can do some teleworking, not all of them. So, yes, there are all of our staff members do come into the transportation building and stuff with some regularity.
Sure. Okay, thank you. Members, we have 2 minutes. We have Representative Lee and the Representative Sexton, or Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just real quickly, just to the local bridge replacement program. So in the slide, you said there's 20 that's ready to go. And so if we were to allocate money into that program, would the funding go to those 20 eligible, or do you have to run a new RFP to address those projects? Because I think that's one of the problems that we found with the DNR. When they gave us a list, we thought we were funding that list, but they had to open up a new RFP. And so I just want to be clear, are we funding the 20 that's on here, or is there a new RFP?
Ms. Dobenberger?
Madam Chair and Chair Lee, thank you for that question. I'm going to turn it to Josh to address that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Josh Kinnaird-Hubinger, MnDOT CFO. If you're talking about the local bridge program, that is a rolling list, so more money directly translates to the projects on the list. Local bridge program requires a solicitation again. So if we fund local roads, we would do another solicitation with that funding.
Okay. Representative Sexton, real quick.
To basically talk to what Representative Perez Vega talked about, you know, Department of Administration came in and said they needed, I thought, a very high number of about $22 million. Maybe staff can back me up on that, to move from the COB over to the Department of Transportation. So they've got their number. DOT has their number. It's all the same building. I feel like we need a joint presentation to understand what are we really doing with all this money.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, we have the Historical Society.
And Mr. Kelleher, you have a really lengthy presentation here. We're going to ask you for 15 minutes, okay?
Madam Chair, my name is Kent Whitworth, Service Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society, Government Relations and Public Policy.
Madam Chair, I am Marae Bjornberg, and I am the Senior Director of Capital Planning and Archaeology for the Historical Society.
Great.
And 15 minutes is fine. We'll move right along. So, Chair Franson, Chair Lee, members of the Capital Investment Committee, thank you so much for taking a few minutes this morning to review the Minnesota Historical Society's 2026 capital budget request. I can't tell you how much we appreciate the stops that you have made at our historic sites, not only in the fall, but also in this winter. We hope that you found it helpful to see firsthand these significant places that are very important to how Minnesotans learn about their past. So, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, we will pause briefly on our mission statement and skip over the strategic priorities, but we wanted to leave those in the printed material so that the committee would have a sense of who we are, what we're doing, and where we are going. So our mission statement says that we will serve all the people of Minnesota by creating powerful engagement with history to cultivate curiosity and foster a more inclusive, empathetic, and informed society. So the work that we do is carried out in many different forms, but in this context, today's discussion, most of our work frequently takes place at historic sites, or put in another way, it is history where it happened. So, Madam Chair, the Minnesota Historical Society brings three requests to our capital budget for 2026, and we'll touch briefly on each one. The Preservation and Access to History, or PATH project, will help ensure that we have the proper facilities for long-term care of collections. Historic site asset preservation will enable us to care for some of Minnesota's most significant historic places. This is, frankly, basic nuts and bolts infrastructure work to make sure that these places are safe and available for visitors for generations to come. And the County and Local Historic Preservation Grants Program helps cities and counties take care of their most important structures. This year, our number one priority for 2026 is the PATH project, as I said, to care for collections. Again, we'd like to express our appreciation to the committee for taking time to visit our collections facilities, in particular our off-site collection storage building on the east side of St. Paul. The goal of this project, simply stated, is to secure collections in proper environmental conditions so that they will be available not only for present-day use, but also preserved for future generations. The project has two major components. One is to update the state-owned facility that you toured at 1500 Mississippi Street here in St. Paul. And the second part of the second component is to utilize planned unfinished collection space at the Minnesota History Center. As mentioned on our tour, our forward-thinking predecessors knew that at some point we would run out of space for various types of collections. Well, I'm here to say that that day has arrived. Fortunately, as you've seen, there is unfinished space available within the footprint of the History Center, but we would need to outfit that with proper environmental equipment and climate controls to house collections. On the slide before you now, you can see images of collections in state archives and in manuscripts. It's important to note that while this building, the Minnesota History Center, is in a very important legislative district, I think Representative Perez Vega would agree with that, MNHS collections come from across the state of Minnesota. For example, our Minnesota State Archives hold records from 4,000 units of government, everything from townships, school districts, cities, counties, watershed districts, state agencies, boards and commissions, courts, jails, and prisons, In addition to collections representing businesses and nonprofit organizations from throughout Minnesota. Simply put, these collections facilities house items from every legislative district in the state. The Minnesota Historical Society is honored, and we take seriously the opportunity to preserve this history, and it is critical that these collections remain in proper environmental conditions. The facility at 1500 Mississippi Street in St. Paul has served us well, frankly, for several decades, for many decades, and it's time for significant renewal. We've had engineers take a look at this building, and with what we consider a relatively modest investment, we can provide a place for collections for the next several generations. Chair Franson, Chair Lee, members of the committee, since the last capital budget cycles, we have sharpened our pencils and done further work on this project. And we have a reasonable cost that compares very favorably to similar facilities being constructed by sister historical organizations in other states. We are, however, an 18-inch heavy snowstorm away from a real disastrous situation with this building, particularly as it applies to our roof. So there is urgency to move forward with this project. I'll now hand off to my colleague, David Kelleher.
Mr. Kelleher, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, again, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you. Our next request is historic sites asset preservation. And as you saw on your visits over the fall and early winter, we are responsible for a wide network of historic sites, over 150 buildings statewide. Half of these buildings are over 100 years old and require some special care. These buildings are in the statutorily defined state historic sites network, so therefore they're a state responsibility. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this diagram gives you a conceptual sense of how we get to the numbers in our asset preservation request in that statewide network. We estimate that the replacement value of the buildings, structures, and landscapes across the state is about $433 million. If you estimate that annual wear and tear, 4%, say you have a 25-year roof and the cost each year to put some money aside for that is 4%, then we come up with a number for deferred maintenance of about $88 million. So as we look at that 4% in terms of what our request is, what the appropriations have been on this bar graph, that 4% value would be about $22, $23 million each year. And that's what's reflected in our request for 2026. Looking back over the last few years, appropriations have been in the $5 million, $4 million to $5 million range. 2023 was a very helpful year to get caught up on this backlog, but the 20-year average is certainly well below the amount needed to keep up to preserve these important historic structures. Madam Chair, members of the committee, our asset preservation request for 2026 totals $22.8 million. We have a list of the projects that would be funded through that request if appropriated, and those numbers are our best estimate today. When you go out to bid and do design work, those numbers certainly change a little bit, but that's our best guess right now to get up to $22.8 million. And I will turn it over to Murray Bjornberg at this point.
Madam Chair, so this is something that we use to plan out our projects. A lot of our projects are on Murray Bjornberg for the record. Thank you. A lot of our projects are at historic sites on structures that, as David mentioned, are 100 years old or larger or longer. And so often they require meeting specific standards and having regulatory reviews by State Historic Preservation Office, Tribal Historic Preservation Offices, and the National Park Service often. So design can sometimes take a little bit longer. I am happy to say that of the 2023 appropriation, all of our projects are either in construction or will be in construction this summer season. So that will be very exciting. And of our 2025 allocation, we are moving into design on those right now. So hope to be in construction for those in 2027. Some recently completed projects that we have, masonry work at James J. Hill House, roof replacement at Forest History Center. As many of you recall from your visit to Split Rock, we have done a large trails and landscape rehabilitation project to improve accessibility at the site and are actually working on a project at the lighthouse right now. Scaffolding will go up next week. Re-roofing at historic Fort Snelling. Some projects that are coming up, Harkin Store, as you can see, we're replacing the roof on that, much needed. Similarly, Oliver Kelly Farm replacing the roof and also siding window rehabilitation there. Fort Snelling Masonry, that is a roof at Mill City Museum on the grain elevator. So if you can imagine the gold medal flower sign, that is some of the roof conditions below that. So replacing that is really essential. Part of our 2026 request projects, masonry stabilization at Fort Ridgely, exterior preservation at Mayo, Fort Snelling Building 17, and the Link interior preservation. Again, more projects over at Mill City. That Mill City elevator number one, that concrete, you can see that, again, is sort of crumbling off, so really needing to do that essential preservation work to stabilize those structures. Similarly, re-roofing Mille Lacs Museum and preservation at Lac Qui Parle. I'll hand it back over to David.
Madam Chair, our third and final request is the County and Local Historic Preservation Grant Program. This competitive grant program requires a local match and allows cities and counties to take care of their most significant historic structures. These grants have gone for libraries, city halls, county courthouses to make sure that cities and counties have the funding available to take care of their historic structures in a historically responsible way.
Chair Franson, Chair Lee, members of the committee, thank you again for your time this morning and most importantly for your support of these important historic places. We would be happy to answer any questions you might have at this time.
Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. Private donations. A lot of us like history a lot. Are any of those being allocated towards preservation of some of these facilities?
Chair Franson, Representative Sexton, on occasion we pursue private sector support for this kind of asset preservation. As you probably know, we've got a robust advancement team, and I am pleased to report with regard to the Oliver Kelly Farm, we've worked with Travelers and received a $125,000 grant, as well as substantial volunteer support that will take place this summer. So we were one of a handful of national projects identified. So that's one example of how we are pursuing private sector support across the functions, but in this case, asset preservation.
All right, thank you. The governor has you at, looks like $3.5 million compared to your $46,645. Can you explain what's going on there with the numbers?
Well, the request we made was for the needs both on asset preservation side and for the PATH project.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Keller.
It's hard to look at all of the, as you all know, there are a lot of requests out there, and the governor had to sort through the $5 billion worth of requests and prioritize his priorities.
The same job this committee has to do, yeah. All right, next up we have Representative Carroll, and then we are going to move to our final presentation.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be real quick. So on the county and local historic preservation grants, that doesn't seem like very much, 1.250, with all the different demand. So how do you allocate that?
Madam Chair, Representative Carroll, that's a competitive grant process. We have a grants review committee that looks at the applications that come in. There's a staff review of whether the projects are ready to go, and you're absolutely right, that's not a lot of money for 87 counties and 800 cities and counties, so there are a lot of needs out there in that area as well.
Thank you. And if I may,
Representative Carroll.
So real quick, is there an average size, or is it just dependent?
Mr. Keller. Madam Chair, Representative Carroll, it depends. Those grants have ranged from $50,000 to $200,000 or $300,000. It just depends on what comes in. And as I mentioned earlier, they are required to provide a match. So they're participating at the city and county level with assistance from this committee.
Okay. And Representative Perez Vega, we got 30 seconds.
Let me go really fast then, Chair. Thank you. I love the Historical Society over there and the projects that you've been doing and really trying to gain more cultural competency within your exhibits. My daughter's kind of like a little ambassador. She was there for their first grade class at a field trip on Friday and loves the tornado room. I want to address, so you're asked, and this is very sensitive to my community and particularly and the Bedote site of the most sacred Dakota where the Mississippi and the Minnesota River connect, you're asking for close to $7 million for Fort Snelling repairs, and in particularly in this moment where we are facing a target environment of the Whipple building right there. What is the federal government's response to a site that has a lot of trauma? And I know you guys have been doing a lot of connection with the indigenous community and prayers and trying to figure things out here, but, you know, requesting $7 million for that site, it feels a little insensitive to our state right now.
And who would like to take that question?
I'll start, Madam Chair.
Right, Mr. Whitworth.
Representative Perez Fagan. What I would say is that this is a running list of needs, and so I think that Fort Snelling project would have hit our list of capital needs long before what's unfolded in the last several months. Thank you for acknowledging the work that we've done with our Indian Advisory Council, our Dakota Community Council, who is a partner on the revitalization of Fort Snelling. That's something that we are trying to work on day in and day out. So this is reflecting needs that have been identified months, maybe even a year or two ago. And understand, though, that the appearance in the moment is not necessarily what we would have had in mind.
Madam Chair.
We are out of time.
Just really quick, Madam Chair, it's really quick. Promise you.
Representative Vega.
Thank you. Didn't you guys get like $34 million not too long ago, though, for Fort Snelling site?
Madam Mr. Chair, Keller. Representative Perez Vega, the revitalization project that allowed us to rehab Building 18 was a $15 million appropriation. We did add to that with non-state funds. That's for a visitor center. I would add to your previous question that the Whipple building is across the highway, a different place. And I think at this moment, our buttons say history matters. And now is the time when we need to study history and learn about that entire area, which, as you pointed out, is important to all Minnesotans from all walks of life, and having the proper facilities so that people can come in and learn in that place is really important right now.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
We have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If you want to make your way up, you've got 20 minutes. That includes questions. Welcome to the committee, and if you want to state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members.
That is a beautiful photo.
Apologize, Chair. It's not going over. For the record,
that's all right. This is just your time.
My name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and thank you for having us today and for your support of previous projects, whether they are local projects for solid waste activities or our efforts to provide safe drinking water and clean up contaminated sites. Just a quick reminder of the agency's mission here is to protect and improve the environment and human health. And as we selected our priorities for bonding projects, we really looked at addressing generational challenges that impact the health and human health and the environment, along with our waste infrastructure in the state and how that aligns with our state waste hierarchy, making sure that we have increased environmental benefits from it, and also our climate action framework. So the first project I'd like to talk about is our statewide drinking water contamination mitigation grant program. This is a new grant program that the legislature created last year. We appreciate this. This really works in combination with some other programs to provide safe drinking water to Minnesota residents. This program focuses on private well users and how do we, when they have exceedances in their drinking water or various contaminants, how do we provide them safe drinking water? And unfortunately, we are seeing a number of private wells or other drinking water systems across the state being impacted by PFAS or 1,4-dioxin at levels that are exceeding our drinking water pieces. We have a list of projects. The request this year is for $1.5 million in geo bonds and $650,000 in general fund would go to a project that is near one of our closed landfills in Blaine. It's a Johnson Brothers closed landfill. The closed landfill program was created in the early 90s by the legislature so that the state would have into perpetuity the care and management of these facilities, including addressing the impacts from them for 114 sites. And so we have about 20 homes in this area in our first phase that have been impacted with PFAS or 1,4-dioxin exceedances. And this project would allow for us to build a water main using the bonding dollars and then the cash, a connection to the homes to provide safe drinking water. This is much more economical than the alternative, which would be building individual treatment systems for each of the homes and have a long-term cost for the state. The second project is our Sustainable and Construction Demolition Waste Transition Grant Program. This is a new grant program. It would help our local governments address construction and demolition landfills waste. The request here is for $5 million to get the program started. Unfortunately, as we have been looking at our landfills, and especially our C&D, our construction demo landfills, they are online, which allows for contaminants, many types, including VOCs, PFAS, arsenic, manganese, and others to leave these landfills, get into the groundwater, and move beyond the landfills themselves, and have, in some cases, impacted private drinking water wells. The grant program would be twofold. One is to create an enhanced cover program so that as these landfills are closed, we have better protection on it to reduce the risk and the potential for the contamination to continue to spread. In addition, the MPCA is in the process of updating our rules so that C&D landfills in the future would have to be designed in, as modern landfills are, having a liner underneath and cover and collecting the leachate. But what this means is that a number of facilities may close their online locations and move to a transfer station, a hub and spoke. They would regionalize. And the money could also be used to help with that transition, providing transfer stations, recycling facilities at these locations. The third and final project is our Addressing Legacy Contamination Through Superfund. In 2020, the legislature used appropriation bonds for four projects to clean up Superfund sites. These are contaminated sites that have no viable responsible party. It then falls upon the state to do the work. What we are proposing to do is that we are well on our way to finishing three of the projects. The fourth has had some delays because of increased cost. And what we'd like to do is add a fifth project to this list, which is in Hibbing, an old gas manufacturing plant to do the cleanup there. The project would be $2.1 million. However, what we're asking for is not additional dollars, rather to use the previously appropriated money for this project. This would allow for us to move in a timely project today. and then we will move on to that fifth project at a future time. Finally, just a summary here of the various projects that we are requesting from. Again, a note that the addressing legacy contamination is not new dollars, just expanding the use of a current appropriation made by the legislature. So in total, we have a little over $6.5 million in requests, $6.5 million being GO bonds and $650,000 for cash. Chair and committee members, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, and thank you for your time.
All right, Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. Are you familiar with the contamination in Blooming Prairie? It's not actually in my district, but it's immediately south of the border of my district.
Mr. Cadella.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we are familiar with a project, with a highway project involving some contamination.
Correct. Who do I talk to, as well as Representative Mueller, to talk about possibly some Superfund dollars and getting it on your list? It's been difficult to figure out the right point of contact.
Mr. Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members.
It's Miss. Not Mr.
Sorry. Sorry, Chair and committee members. The efforts for Superfund are if we don't have viable, responsible parties for various projects and if there is the immediate risk being addressed. Some projects fall outside that scope. For instance, if it is for a development project where immediate work is not done, just given the limited amount of dollars, we focus our dollars on those that are ready to go and need to have a source reduction to protect human health and environment. There are other pots of funds to help with brownfield projects. In the past, the legislature has funded that through other various means.
So I guess further in the question.
Representative Sexton.
Thank you, ma'am. The plume is expanding into the residential area. What more do we need to do? We can take this offline, but I'd really like a phone call back from your office to set up an appointment.
Mr. Kadelka?
Chair and committee members would be happy to have more conversations. Thank you.
Representative Scarbo.
Thank you, Chair. Question about the Blaine cleanup part. Do the owners of the landfill have any responsibility?
Mr. Kadelka?
Chair and committee members, because it entered into the closed landfill program, it is now the state that is responsible for the facilities. The closed landfill program was created in the early 90s because we were bringing landfill sites through the Superfund process. Unfortunately, any cleanup through the Superfund process can be contentious when there's one or two responsible parties. What had happened as we moved forward with landfills in the North Metro is that the landfill owner, haulers, and others that we knew had brought material there then went on and asked for contributions or sued every business or person that may have brought waste there. So what the legislature said is because we were being bogged down in administrative and legal work and not actually getting the cleanup, because it was a societal problem, the state would take over the sites. And as a result, entering into the program, this facility and the other 114 are now the state taking care of the location. As part of that legislation then, the former or other previous responsible parties do not have to take on those costs. It is now the state.
Okay. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned with the Superfund site, there were four projects. You are adding one, and you're putting one on hold for Hibbing. Could you tell me which project is being put on hold and what criteria you use to determine which project you should proceed with? Thank you.
Mr. Kadelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. The project that's not moving forward is the Duluth dump. And what has happened is we started getting into the design, the expense of it nearly doubled, and there was not enough dollars there from the allocation to move that project forward. What we ended up doing is going back and doing more investigation and additional feasibility studies, and we're looking for other remedies that could address the situation. We've been able to select that, but in the meantime, it's moved the project back a year or two. And so what we're looking to do is this one is ready in the Hibbing situation, move that project forward. We're continuing to do the work for the Duluth dump that we're working on now, design of that. And we may need additional dollars for the construction, but we're looking to see how we can do it within the current dollar framework if possible, and if not, come back to the legislature to break up the project and do later phases with additional funding.
Okay. Anybody else? No? Okay. Well, with that, I want to thank you for your time. Appreciate you all. And members, the next committee hearing we have will be on, today's the 10th, March 12th. Any questions, comments, concerns? No? All right. Meeting adjourned.